You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, last night I read to you the platform of the new third party in the United States political system. This party is going to work, for it is the Constitution Party. It's the first time that I'm aware of that there has been such a grassroots groundswell of desire and concern to return to the roots, the ideals and principles upon which this great nation was founded. The Constitution Party intends to provide the means whereby, if there is enough time, that can be accomplished. We have an 800 number that beginning Monday you will be able to call. I don't know exactly what time on Monday the number will be in service, but sometime Monday you will be able to call this number and get information. So write it down. 1-800-932-9888. That's 1-800-932-9888. If you'd like to write to the Constitution Party and request information or request how you can be a part of the turning around of America back to what this nation was intended to be, write the Constitution Party, Post Office Box 7565. That's P.O. Box 7565, Beverly Hills, California, 90212. That's P.O. Box 7565, Beverly Hills, California, 90212. Now, last night I read you the platform. Tonight I'm going to talk to you about what that platform means and the historical context of the roots, the founding of this nation. And I'm going to attempt to steer you as much as I am able in this 1 hour period of time back on track. For you see, folks, we've been derailed, seriously derailed. Many of you out there don't even have the slightest idea what I'm talking about. Most of you, if you've been listening to shortwave radio, and specifically this broadcast, for quite some time, then you not only know what I'm talking about, but you're probably one of the many who have called and expressed your joy and happiness and hope with what we have brought into being. And you know something, in all the calls that I've received since airing the broadcast and reading the platform of the Constitution Party last night, I have not received one single negative comment. And that is amazing. For I don't think I've ever done anything on the Hour of the Time that has not invited some negativity from some corner, from somewhere, from someone. I think from the comments that I've heard that we're on the right track. And I think that if there is any hope left that we can turn this country around and realize the great American dream, that this is it. I'm going to tell you just a few of the people and this is just a few, because there are quite a few founding members, but this is just a few of the founding members of the Constitution Party. Robert Atkins is a very famous medical doctor. Larry Beecraft. He is an attorney who has beaten the IRS in tax cases. He worked with Benson on the books. There's two volumes entitled The Law That Never Was. Bob Bishop, a newsletter writer. Jim Blanchard, he helped legalize gold. He's a very famous newsletter writer. Doug Casey. Doug Casey is the author of the biggest selling financial book in history. He also wrote a very good book on freedom. Larry Dodge, fully informed jury association. Ron Paul, he ran for president on the Libertarian Party and fought for taxpayers' rights when he was a member of Congress, realizing that Congress was stacked against him, and being the lone fighter, he decided to get out from under their control where he could do some good. Now, we're going to try to put him back in there so he can throw some punches with the good that he's done out here. Bob Prechter, famous author of the Elliott Wave Theory. Aaron Russo, producer of Trading Places with Eddie Murphy and The Rose with Bette Midler. He's the winner of an Emmy, a Tony, and had films nominated for various Academy Awards. Linda Thompson, and for those of you who listen to this broadcast, there is no explanation necessary when I mention her name. James Turk, author and newsletter writer. Jonathan Wright, famed doctor and author, the subject of several broadcasts of the hour of the time when his clinic was raided by the Gestapo, you know who. That'll just give you some idea, and those are just a few of the names. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be telling you more about who helped found this party and what it's all about. As the days and weeks and months go by, we want you to get the literature. We want you to get a copy of the platform. We want you to register this party in your state. We want you to get active, mobilize, organize. The Constitution Party represents the Founding Fathers, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, the guarantee of a Republican form of government.
And to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. To the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. The Pledge of Allegiance to the flag and the pledge to the ideals of our forefathers. Men who fought and died in the building of this great nation. It's a pledge to fulfill our duties and obligations as citizens of the United States and to uphold the principles of our Constitution. And last but not least, it's a pledge to maintain the four great freedoms cherished by all Americans. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. I pledge allegiance.
Many of you have confided to me over the years that you see no hope, and at times I have felt the same way. Tonight I'm going to give you hope, I'm going to give you back your roots, and I'm going to give you an opportunity to participate in a great healing, a great movement, a great coming together across this nation. If you were surprised by the parole movement, ladies and gentlemen, stick around. You have seen nothing yet. Thomas Jefferson, in a letter to Edward Carrington on January 16, 1787, made this statement: "Cherish, therefore, the spirit of our people and keep alive their attention. If once they become inattentive to the public affairs, you and I, and Congress, and assemblies, judges and governors shall all become wolves. It seems to be the law of our general nature." And so it is, ladies and gentlemen, as you've heard me say over and over on this broadcast, those who dream of a utopian government upon this earth are truly dreaming. They are deluding themselves, for the very basic nature of man forbids it. The concept that imperfect man can be trusted to rule over imperfect man is erroneous, at best. That is why our forefathers cautioned us not to involve ourselves in the affairs of foreign nations, not to trust those that we send to government to do the right thing, but to watch them constantly. One of the greatest pieces of advice that we were ever given in the beginning of this country was that freedom is dangerous. Freedom also bears with it great responsibility. It requires eternal watchfulness, constant vigilance, and great personal sacrifice. Those who are not willing to fulfill these requirements do not long remain free. I quote James Wilson: "A good constitution is the greatest blessing which a society can enjoy." He said this in his oration at Philadelphia on July 4, 1788, celebrating the adoption of the Constitution of the United States. Wilson, who signed both the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, preached startlingly democratic theories, more democratic than the ideas of any other delegate to the Constitutional Convention. Yet Wilson emphasized the duties as well as the rights of citizens. Quote, "Need I infer that it is the duty of every citizen to use his best and most unremitting endeavors for preserving it pure, healthful, and vigorous? For the accomplishment of this great purpose, the exertions of no one citizen are unimportant. Let no one, therefore, harbor for a moment the mean idea that he is and can be of no value to his country. Let the contrary manly impression animate his soul. Everyone can, at many times, perform to the state useful services, and he who steadily pursues the road of patriotism has the most inviting prospect of being able, at some time, to perform eminent ones." End quote. Wilson's argument is quite as sound now as it was two centuries ago. The success of the American Republic as a political structure has been the consequence in very large part of the voluntary participation of citizens in public affairs. Enlisting in the army in time of war, serving on school boards, taking part unpaid in political campaigns, petitioning legislatures, supporting the president in an hour of crisis, and in a hundred other great ways, or small, assuming responsibility for the common good. The Constitution has functioned well until this century, most of the time because conscientious men and women gave it flesh. the framers. Ladies and gentlemen, the framers' first assumption was that all just authority for government comes from the people, under God, not from a monarch or a governing class, but from the innumerable citizens who make up the republic. The people delegate to government only so much power as they think it prudent for government to exercise. Government is the people's creation, not their master, and if it were not for the people, would not even exist. Thus, if the people are sovereign, it is the citizens' responsibility to take upon their shoulders the task of seeing that order, justice, and freedom are maintained. The framers' second assumption was that American citizens would undertake responsibility for the ordinary functioning of the civil social order, and that local communities would manage their own affairs. Under their system, the roles of the various levels of government would be minimal and would not unnecessarily intrude into the day-to-day lives of the citizens. The concept that the citizens can be taxed on a local level, the money can make a great circuit through Washington, D.C., and back to the local level in the form of an interstate highway, and you're going to get your money's worth, is a great, great deception. For a great chunk of that money disappears as it makes its way around this great circle. In the matters which most immediately affect private life, power should remain in the hands of the citizens or of the several states, not in the possession of federal government. So at least the Constitution declares Americans have no official cards of identity or internal passports or system of national registration of all citizens, obligations imposed upon citizens in much the rest of the world. And this freedom results from Americans' voluntary assumption of responsibility. And this remained true until people got greedy and for some reason believed that they could allow the government to take X number of dollars from their paycheck, put it into a big pool called the Social Security Administration, which has no pool, ladies and gentlemen. It all goes into the general fund. And that somehow, when they reached their old age, there would be enough to take care of them from this robbery is another great deception. For if each and every American had taken that same amount of money out of his or her own paycheck and invested it in the very lowest interest-bearing investment that they could find, even the lowest savings account in the country, the very lowest return, they would have all been very, very well to do in their old age, would have had no problems whatsoever. But this hoax is still being carried out today against the advice of our founding fathers, against all of the principles and ideals that this nation was based upon. And those who have fallen for it and stayed with it have given up all of this. In matters of public concern, you see, it was the original intent of our founding fathers to keep authority as close to home as possible. The lesser courts, the police, the maintenance of roads and sanitation, the levying of real property taxes, the control of public schools, and many other essential functions still are carried on by the agencies of local community, the township, the village, the city, the county, the voluntary association. Citizens' cooperation voluntary community throughout the United States has been noted and commended in the books of Alexis de Tocqueville, Lord Bryce, Julian Marius, and other distinguished visitors to the United States over the past two centuries. America's citizens, most of them, have believed in a moral order ordained by divine wisdom, and so they have assumed moral responsibilities on an individual basis, including personal responsibility for constitutional government. The more thoughtful citizens have seen society as primarily moral in origin, a community of souls. Behind the outward forms of American political structure lie the old convictions that citizens have duties toward other members of the society, and that a just government must recognize these things. In family, church, and school, until the middle of the 20th century, the rising generation of Americans were taught that they must be personally responsible for their own welfare, for the care of their aging family members, for the security and prosperity of their community, for their patrimony of order and justice and freedom. A sense of responsibility is developed by severe lessons, by private risk, and by accountability, by a humane education, by religious understanding, by knowledge of the past. You see, all of our forefathers came to these shores to escape religious persecution. For us to turn around and practice religious persecution is the utmost hypocrisy. And they would cast us out, were they here? Once upon a time, this sense of responsibility was diffused throughout this American nation. And if it continues to drain away, the consequences will be disastrous. A republic whose citizens, whose leaders indeed are concerned chiefly with looking out for number one and ignoring their responsibilities of citizenship, soon cannot ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, or carry on the other major duties of the state. For they will soon find themselves enslaved. And when the crisis comes, the people may turn in desperation to the hero administrator, the misty figure somewhere at the summit, the knight in shining armor, riding up on a white horse. But in the end, that hero will not save the republic. That hero, ladies and gentlemen, will not save the republic, but will find himself sacrificed to the ignorance of the many. Although he may govern for a time by force, a democratic republic cannot long endure unless a great many of its citizens stand ready and willing to brighten the corner where they are and to sacrifice much for the nation, if need be, even their very lives. For what we have praised our founding fathers for, and those who have died over the countless years to preserve our freedom and the freedom of our posterity, how can we not be willing to give the same? How can you call me and say, Bill, aren't you afraid, when you did not ask me that question when you sent me to fight a war in Vietnam? Why is it that it was okay for me to go fight a war in Vietnam, yet somehow I should be afraid, standing upon my own soil for what I believe in, fighting for my and your liberty? For the past 5 or 6 decades, several perceptive observers have remarked, an increasing proportion of the American population has ceased to feel responsible for the common defense, for productive work, for choosing able men and women to represent them in politics, for accepting personal responsibility for the needs of the community, or even for their own livelihood. And unless this deterioration is arrested, and arrested immediately, the responsible citizens will be too few to support and protect the irresponsible sheeple. By 1978, there were more people receiving regular government checks than there were workers in the private sector. And the statistics now are so dismal that I dare not utter them. What follows? If we are to judge by the history of fallen civilizations is described by Albert J. Nott in his book entitled Memoirs of a Superfluous Man, published in 1943. And I quote, "Closer centralization, a steadily growing bureaucracy, state power and faith in state power increasing, social power and faith in social power diminishing, the state absorbing a continually larger proportion of the national income, production languishing, the state in consequence taking over one essential industry after another, managing them with ever-increasing corruption, inefficiency, and prodigality, and finally resorting to a system of forced labor. Then at some point in this process, a collision of state interests, at least as general and as violent as that which occurred in 1914, will result in an industrial and financial dislocation too severe for the asthenic or weak social structure to bear. And from this, the state will be left to the rusty death of machinery and the causal anonymous forces of dissolution." End quote. Modern civilization offers a great variety of diversions, amusements, and enticements, what used to be called the Roman service, that which the emperor created to take the attention of the mob from the deeds of the emperor, some of them baneful. But modern civilization does not offer many inducements to the performance of duties, except perhaps monetary payment. And certainly it does not teach people that the real reward for responsible citizenship is the preservation of a free society. You see, it is not money that can induce citizens to labor and sacrifice for the common good. They must be moved. They must feel patriotism and their attachment to the Constitution. And patriotism alone, ignorant boasting about one's native land, my country, right or wrong, will never suffice to preserve the Republic. Thus it is that on the occasion of the bicentennial celebration of the Constitution, a mighty effort should have been made and still ought to be made to restore the American public's awareness of the principles of their government, of their responsibilities toward their country, their neighbors, their children, their parents. And where are your parents today? And themselves, to be sure that their patriotism is based upon this solid foundation. No one of you out there knows how late the hour is, but I can assure you that it is later than most people think. Love of the Republic shelters all our other loves, and that love is worth some sacrifice. And that's why, when I read you my creed last night, which I printed in the introduction to my book, printed almost 5 years ago, the order of importance was God, the Constitution and Bill of Rights, and then my family. For love of the Republic shelters all our other loves, and that love is worth some sacrifice. To me, it is worth the ultimate sacrifice, should it be required. Nearly all of us are quick to claim benefits, but not everybody is eager to fulfill obligations. Everybody wanted to see defense cut back, but when they decided to cut back on the base that was in your town, you screamed bloody murder. Everyone believes in free speech until you hear someone say something that you do not like. But you scream bloody murder if someone, anyone, tries to tell you that you cannot espouse your own personal beliefs. And you are quick to condemn your neighbor when the police break down his door without a warrant. seize his property, all without due process, without even being charged for a crime. It's okay, because if the police broke down the door, he must have been guilty of something until your door is broken down. And then you scream bloody murder. Nearly all of us are quick to claim benefits, but not everybody is eager to fulfill obligations. You see, we have become a nation obsessed with rights, forgetful of responsibilities, and only obsessed with the rights that belong to me. Absolutely correct. I see it every day. In an age of seeming affluence, in the greatest nation that's ever existed upon the face of this earth, with the most opportunities, inhabited by the only people who have ever lived who have truly been free, with a government created to protect the rights of the individual, a great many people find it easy to forget that all good things must be paid for by somebody. Paid for through hard work, through painful abstinence, sometimes through bitter sacrifice. I set down some of the causes for the decline of a sense of responsibility among most American citizens. The growth of an American welfare state over the past half century has produced in the minds of a good many men and women the illusion that somehow somebody in Washington can provide for all needs. So why make much effort to fulfill what used to be considered personal responsibilities? As Alexis de Tocqueville remarked a century and a half ago, democracy in the United States will endure until those in power learn that they can perpetuate themselves through taxation. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, the temptation of public men in Washington is always to offer to have the federal government assume fresh responsibilities with consequent decay of local and private vigor. It might be argued that, at least in part, a failure in the proper exercise of citizens' responsibility permitted the development of the welfare state syndrome that the government owes them a living. But in any event, once it got underway and the welfare state grew, the sense of citizens' responsibility and rugged individualism deteriorated and then disappeared. I know very few people who have ever in their life experienced an original thought. They parrot what they see on television, what they hear from those in authority, or from their boss in the corporate world. They do what is expected of them rather than what is responsible of them. The increase of the scale of society and the size of government has bewildered us all, inclining us to think that the individual can accomplish little or nothing in a responsible way, engulfed as he seems to be by the overwhelmingness of it all. I don't know how many of you, I could not count it, have called me to tell me they were so thankful that I was here because they are just one insignificant little lonely person with no means to accomplish anything in the way of correcting the status quo. Forgetting all the while that I am just one lonely, insignificant person who is on a daily basis proving them wrong. It was easier to see one's personal responsibilities in a Massachusetts township or next door to a Virginia courthouse in 1787 than it is to perceive what one's duties to country and community may be in the New York or Los Angeles of 1994. You see, when one contemplates the enormous size of the federal government, then the exercise of individual citizen responsibility seems almost hopeless. I know this because I hear it from you all the time. Until the 1930s, and in many schools later than that, young people learned their responsibilities through the lively study of history, government, and especially imaginative literature that taught them about human dignity and human duties. But in recent decades, especially during the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, the disciplines of history and government have been supplanted by a vague social stew. Everything sort of goes in the pot and stirred all together with a long wooden spoon, and something might come out of it, but what? For it has no foundation, no traditions, no legitimacy, and the study of great literature and philosophical ideas has given way to anthologies of relevant and often depressing third-rate recent writing, politically correct, and most often displayed on videotape. So the function of the schools as places where responsibility would be taught, and expressed hope of several of the framers of the Constitution, John Dickinson among them, has been ignored. Of all social institutions, formerly, the family was most active and successful in teaching young people their responsibilities. But since the Second World War, particularly, the American family has been weakened by economic changes, both parents being gainfully employed, often to pay for increases of taxation in large part, but mainly brought about by a great manipulation, a deception that there was a worldwide shortage of oil, which somehow justified the increase in price of everything, including the quadrupling of the price of the average family home, denying for the first time in the history of this nation a generation the American dream. The triumph of the television set over family conversations, the influence of periodicals read by young people, and a considerable range of challenges to parental authority, many times encouraged by judicial decisions and actions of the education establishment. At the same time, the influence of school teachers and of the clergy in perpetuating this strong sense of responsibility has diminished to the point where it almost does not exist. So in some degree, dear listeners, the restoration of a sense of responsibility depends upon the family's recovery of authority. Authority. For responsibility stems from a sense of belonging and love. All human beings must be loved or they will perish. The fundamental impulse to accept responsibilities and perform duties in every society has been religious in origin. All morals stem from religion. Individuals obey moral laws upon their own personal choice and do their duty because of awareness of duties toward God. Religion teaches that there exist natural laws, and that if any individuals try to ignore those natural laws, they find themselves in peril, individually and as a society. People who deny the reality of the divine tend to shrug off their responsibilities to other men and women. Thus, weakness and religious awareness commonly leads to the decay of personal responsibility in many walks of life. But religious awareness is not religious persecution. You see, in order to escape religious persecution, freedom of religion must be given to all men and women. This nation was not established as a religious country. It was a secular nation established to protect many different religious people of many different faiths, many of whom hated each other. And if it were not for the first article and amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America, it might have been possible in the early years of this nation to set up a state religion which would have persecuted and eliminated all other religions. It is that forbiddance of our government to legislate any recognition of any religion whatsoever that has prevented that persecution. Remember, our forefathers left Europe to come to these shores to escape religious persecution. So that is the basis, the fundamental reason for them being here at all. These, ladies and gentlemen, are only some of the reasons why a permissive society speaks often of rights and very seldom of responsibilities. But a time comes in the course of events when abruptly there is a most urgent need for men and women ready to fulfill high and exacting and dangerous responsibilities, and if there are no such citizens, then liberty can and will be lost. It must be remembered that the great strength of the signers of the Declaration and the framers of the Constitution was that they knew their classical history and how the ancient Greek cities had lost their liberties and how the Roman system had sunk to its ruin under the weight of proletariat and military state. So you may ask what may be done by way of remedy. Although America's social difficulties, ladies and gentlemen, are formidable, probably they are less daunting than those of any other great nation in the world today. The economic resources of the United States remain impressive, and the country's intellectual resources are large beyond imagination. I cannot offer, in the small compass of this hour, a detailed program for the popular recovery of devotion to duty. I can only suggest healing approaches. Like moral virtue, responsibility is first acquired in family and home. Nobody does more to injure a sense of responsibility than a parent who abandons children to the television set and the peer group, liberating them from household chores and study at home, assigning and enforcing duties within home and family, though it may seem stern at first, is kindness not only to the child, but to everybody in the long run. In the family as well as in the school, the imagination and the intellect can be introduced to the literature of responsibility, for it does exist. And young people are much taken with this literature if they can be weaned from the visual stimulus of that great drug called television. And if they have not already been absorbed into a juvenile counterculture. It was not many years ago that boys read, for instance, Theodore Roosevelt's and Henry Cabot Lodge's Hero Tales from American History, with its stirring descriptions of George Washington, of George Rogers Clark conquering the Northwest, of the battles of Trenton, Bennington, Kings Mountain, and Stony Point, locations that I can guarantee that most of you have never heard of, much read about, to confine ourselves to revolutionary fighting of Governor Morris, the most brilliant delegate to the Constitutional Convention, with his one leg and his crippled arm, refusing to flee from the Jacobins in Paris In these true tales, one learns what responsibility requires, what the battle is all about, what the great rewards can be, and the sacrifices that are sometimes required. And it was not many years ago that girls were reading about the heroines of ancient times and modern, about Hypatia, Joan of Arc, Abigail Adams. We learn our duties from learning about men and women who did theirs. I recall James Wilson's words, quoting at the beginning of this broadcast, and I quote, "He who steadily pursues the road of patriotism has the most inviting prospect of being able, at some times, to perform eminent ones," end quote. In schools, the pupils need to be rescued from the sham subjects of social studies and civics, ordinarily the most boring and empty disciplines in school curriculum, and introduced instead to real history, real reality, and to the Constitution and American political institutions, and to the ideals and principles upon which this nation was founded, and for which many thousands of men and women have died throughout the years to preserve and protect, and to pass on down to us their posterity. From studying genuine historical figures and genuine politics and literature of the past, young people can come to apprehend what a citizen can do for himself, for herself, and for our country. Perhaps the best way to renew responsibility in American society is to assume responsibilities oneself. I have attempted to do that and function as some kind of an example to at least some of you who have read my book, who have listened to me expounding during a lecture and during this broadcast. I have challenged you. For many of you, it may be difficult to find the time and painful to fight one's way into politics at any level. Nevertheless, some honest men and women must do so if the Republic is to endure another 5 years. And yes, it is that close, and yes, we are that desperate. Or perhaps just to the end of the 20th century. And yes, we are that close and we are that desperate. From running for Congress to campaigning for the office of drain commissioner, from publishing a newspaper to writing a letter to the editor, there is no end to the responsibilities that may be undertaken to the general benefit of us all. The apparatus for doing one's political duty still exists thanks to our Constitution, and it is easier than you think. If you will learn the common law, if you will learn the real law, if you will learn constitutional law, if you will understand the statute law, the commercial law, and the deception that has been wreaked upon us, and make yourself once again sovereign citizens of the Republic, you can run and win in any race for any office which you desire. For the Constitution of every state of the Union requires that to hold office you must be a citizen of the state in which you run. And I can guarantee you all, every single one of those running against you are citizens of the United States of America, 14th Amendment, subject to the jurisdiction of the Federal District of Columbia and its territories. Therefore,
If you can prove that two sovereign people voted for you in any election and you challenge the election results based upon the fact that you are the only citizen of the state running in the election, the court has no choice but to award you the winner. Do you understand what I'm telling you, ladies and gentlemen? It's time to turn their own deception against them. And those of us who are smart enough to understand what is happening and how to work their own deception, their own laws, to our advantage, can and will be victorious. But the only place that you will find the men and the women who have this knowledge and who are willing to take great risks and make great personal sacrifices in the Constitution Party. The Constitution Party. Not the lying Republican Party or the lying Democratic Party, who are really both one and the same, but the Constitution Party, based upon the ideals and principles that I have been discussing with you tonight, and many, many more, which we will discuss again and again and again until once again the hearts and minds of the American people swell with pride and understanding. And stand once again kings and queens in their own right, but without wearing crowns. Free, but responsible, exercising their will, but never damaging or hurting another or their property, respecting other people regardless of their race, religion, or creed. Responsible. Ultimately, the recovery of a sense of responsibility is bound up with the recovery of the old concept and virtue of piety, gratitude. Gratitude towards one's ancestors, concern for one's children and descendants, one's neighbor. Such a sense of responsibility is in keeping with the philosophy upon which the nation was built. Creator endowed rights and responsibilities. The Constitution set in place to protect those rights against usurpation by government. In your own circumstances, you may encounter opportunities for the renewal of responsibility more promising where you live than any suggested here tonight. In any society, it always has been a minority who have upheld order and justice and freedom. If only one, just one, out of every 10 citizens of the United States of America should vigorously fulfill his or her responsibilities to our civil social order, why, ladies and gentlemen, we would never need to fear for the future of this great nation. The greatest nation that has ever existed upon the face of this earth. And we, above all of the peoples who have ever lived, have really and truly been blessed. For we have, and still are, even at this late date, the only people who have ever lived upon this earth who have ever truly been free. You see, sometimes this swells up in my chest and I feel what I am saying. And I hope that in some small way I've been able to impart that same emotional upwelling, that feeling to you. For I love this nation and I love you. Join the Constitution Party. It's our last hope. Post Office Box 7565, Beverly Hills, California, 90212. the Constitution Party. Post Office Box 7565, Beverly Hills, California, 90212. On Monday, you may call this number, 1-800-932-9888. That's 1-800-932-9888. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. God bless you, and God bless the Republic.
Of a country road on the wind it comes to call, and it sings in the farms and the factory towns, and where you think there'd be no song at all. And the words are the words that our fathers heard as they whistled down the years, and the name of the song is the name of the dream that's music to our ears. America, America, the dream goes on. America, America, and the dream goes on. The words that we read on the courthouse walls are the words that make us feel. And the more we remember the way we began, the closer we get to the best we can be. Was there ever a time we forgot its worth, all the struggles and the scars? If we leave to the children a sky full of hope and a flag that's filled with fire. America, America, and the dream
tomorrow will always be free.